Sorry, I am going to spend the next hour, 15 minutes talking to you about compliance as it stretches across Exchange, SharePoint, Link, a number of different avenues. We're going to kind of run the gamut on our compliance story from a server perspective in this session. A little bit of background on me. I've kind of done a lot of different things at Microsoft. I started off in support. So I was the guy that answered the phones, and I moved my way to consulting. I was in MCS for 5, 6 years. For the last 5 years, I've been doing product management. So I've been the product manager for Exchange, and then I was a product manager for all of our compliance workspaces across a number of different portfolios. And recently, actually, since I signed up for TechEd Australia, I've now taken over the OneNote role, which is interesting because OneNote is very different than the compliance thing. OneNote is on the brainstorming ideas, coming up with interesting things, and compliance is making sure that those ideas don't go away. So is there anyone here using OneNote? Anyone love it? There we go. So as part of that, I thought it would be an interesting way to do a session that wasn't your kind of standard session where you have PowerPoint after PowerPoint after PowerPoint. And so instead, I'm going to OneNote you to death. I have a number of different things that I'm going to show you. But it's all going to be in a different sort of medium that I'm bringing it to. So let me switch over. And I'm just going to go into full screen mode. And I'm going to just kind of work my way through and just talk to you. There's some echo. Is that OK? Can you guys hear, or is it just me? And a little bit about some of the customer needs. When we set about designing all of our compliance capabilities across Office, there was really four things that really bubbled up for us. One is that there was a really spectacular user and admin experience, right? So I'm thinking about the people, making sure that was, these are eyes. Making sure that the user experience is first and foremost what's out there. We looked at the products that were there in the market. We looked at other archiving solutions, other compliance solutions, and the end user experience was terrible. I was talking to someone yesterday who uses a product from Symantec, Enterprise Vault, and just the experience of, I'm accessing an email today, I want to find it, I use the normal Outlook search. When I want to look at something from a month ago, I need to use a different interface and try and find it, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. From a mobile device, it's a different experience. It's a pretty bad user experience from that level. In parallel, the admin experience is very different, right? As you think about Exchange or your SharePoint scalability or high availability, it's something that you have you've taken a very discrete strategy on how you're thinking about that data. What are the number of nines that you're experiencing with that? If you have to then make a distinguishing line and say that, well, current data we're thinking about as a 3-9 strategy or a 2-9 strategy versus old data where we think it's a little bit different and you have different storage architectures and different networks and different backup requirements, it makes it a very painful experience for an organization. And as you can see, I have some co-authors here. So Jeff and Paul are sitting in the first row, and I've given them access to modify my deck at a moment's whim. So if you see something interesting pop up and I'm standing far away from that, you'll see what's going on. The second thing that we really thought about during a lot of our research, and we spent about 10,000 hours of research just thinking about what the best thing to do for customers is making sure that we had a very, very solid data governance policy, or data governance engines and capabilities. So that if you say, hey, I need to make sure this content expires after 3 months or 6 years or whatever period of time, that it does expire out of the system. This is really a risk mitigation standpoint, right? You want to make sure that if you're only keeping content around for a period of time, you're only keeping it around for that same period of time. You're not leaving it for discoverability purposes later on. The third thing is really just around having a very solid immutability story. So I'll pretend to draw a shield. And just making sure that if, from the other side, if you are keeping data, you know it's there. It's not changed. It's not tampered with. It is the unaltered version of the truth. Making sure that there is a single version of that truth is something that's very, very important to us. And so we thought about it very differently than some of these other vendors that have been in market. For instance, doing things that aren't hardware-based, right? We take a very software-based approach to all these problems, and we've worked with regulatory bodies around the world to make sure that our immutability story is very, very solid. And finally, thinking about e-discovery, making that all that data that you find in your organization discoverable, right? It's not great if you can have all this data, but no way to actually find and locate that needle in the haystack. So I'm going to spend some time going over all of these different pillars, if you will, as we move across the deck. Is that a magnifying glass? We've got an artist over there. All right. So for us, when we think about compliance, it's a number of different discrete technologies that make up that story. For us, there's actually two ways of thinking about that large bucket of buckets. The first is on the preserving, looking at that content and making sure that you're containing it all up. So this is where we think about our content management solutions across the different portfolios. From an Exchange perspective, having that in-place archive, so you have a repository that's there either in the cloud or on-premises. From a SharePoint perspective, making sure it's all stored in SkyDrive Pro, so your documents are kept on the server infrastructure. The second bucket under the preserve category is data governance, as I was just talking about. And we have a number of discrete technologies that are in there as well. One is our DLP solution, which is built into Exchange 2013 and Exchange Online. I'm going to give you a pretty good, demo of what's coming with the DLP capabilities, or what's there with DLP capabilities. The third is around preservation, right? Making sure that content is stored and held in lock and key across not just Exchange content as it was in Exchange 2010, or separately in Link, or separately in SharePoint, but having that policy engine to say, I'm going to preserve content as it lands across Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. And you'll hear this term being used more and more by Microsoft called in-place, our in-place archive, our in-place story with hold, our in-place story with all of our different data types to make sure that it's being leveraged and you're not having multiple versions of the truth. And on the right side, you know, as I mentioned in the previous, I'm going to call them slides. It's great to have all the data, but having robust tools to examine is also very important. And I'm going to spend a lot of time talking to you about just the raw nature of what we're doing from e-discovery. It's a pretty big beast. We've spent a lot of engineering effort on making something that we think is very, very powerful organizations. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the end user experience. How many people, just to kind of get a hand, how many people are using Outlook 2013? And how many people are using Exchange 2013 or the current version of Exchange Online? So one thing you'll notice is that, or actually even Exchange 2010, for that matter. We wanted to make sure that the archive experience, as users move data from their current mailbox to a historical location, that they kept that same experience that they were used to using. Whether it's things like being able to reply to an email or forward an email or action it, whether it was in the primary mailbox or archive, it didn't matter. It should be the same experience to that user. And so we did things like making that experience map exactly. So you have, like, if I look at this archive for Sarah, you can see that, you know, we have the same folder names. And as content expires out, we're going to create those same folder names. So Sarah can look and find all that content that she expected to be in that September category, you know, September folder, in that September folder in the archive. This is important for a few reasons. One is, you know, we've done a lot of research on the way people actually use email. It's obviously important business for us. And people distinctly fall more in one of two buckets. The first is people use data People store email in what we call a filing capability, where they take content, take emails that come in, and move it into a folder, project one, project two, timeline, or however you organize your data. But some people are much more filing oriented. And then there's another segment of people that are more piling oriented, where they just have a few buckets, and they just use search very, very heavily to find this data. So just a quick poll. If you had to put yourself into one of those two buckets, whether you file your emails more often or whether you pile into them and move things around, I'm just curious, how many people would consider themselves more of a search piling of that data? And then just to make sure, how many people are more into filing content, filing email? It looks like it's a 60-40 split. So it's a good distinction between the two audiences. The reason I made that point is it's very important to us to keep that user experience. If we told that 40% or the 60% that your way of doing email is wrong, you should do it this other way, you're gonna have a mess on your hands, because you're now telling people that the way that they're doing business is incorrect. When email should be a productivity tool instead of a methodology for getting your work done. Another thing we've done to change the way, to improve the way that people are collaborating, is we've introduced this capability called site mailboxes. So historically, and actually probably even today, if you're collaborating with someone, and you're most likely using email, right? You're marking up a Word document, attaching it to that email message, sending it to four different people. They're making their changes and sending it back to you, especially if it's outside your organization. Sure, there's better ways of doing it, but this is the way that a lot of people like to work, and it has that benefit of just always being there. But SkyDrive Pro is so much better for actually collaborating. You get co-authoring. You get real-time changes. You can see what's going on. You don't have to worry about pulling all that content back together and putting it into the same final version, final one, final two, final three. So what we've done is introduce site mailboxes, which allow an organization to say, you know what, I'm working on Project Eagle here. I'm going to create a site mailbox for this, and I'm going to give it to Ben and Jeff and Paul, and they're going to actually, it'll provision for them. And this is a unified place that I can store my emails, I can still store my SharePoint documents, and I can use that as a collaborative environment for an organization. And the interesting thing is, the emails that are in that site mailbox are stored in Exchange. The documents that are in this site mailbox are stored in SharePoint, but to the end user, it's a seamless experience, and they're getting the best of both worlds. So this environment here, if I click on the shared documents under the inbox right here, I can see all of these documents here, these six documents, and they're actually stored in SharePoint. If I open up SharePoint, I can see the emails, and I can see the documents that are stored there as well. So no matter if you're using it from the Exchange side or the SharePoint side, you're able to access that content back and forth, really improving the collaborative experience for organizations. Excuse me. From a SkyDrive Pro perspective, we've also made some of the actual creation experience better, which is important from a compliance perspective, because people are going to create content anywhere. They're going to use their phones, they're going to use their emails, they're going to use their web browser, and making that built directly into the user interface, just to be able to create a new file, is also important. I'm not going to spend too much time on that. As you think about other ways that compliance officers and people actually think about data, one thing that's very important to compliance officers when I speak to them or spoke to them is just the ability to look at metadata. Some organizations have policies to say, if you're working on a project, you need to tag this, or you need to mark it as something that's built, that's a part of this project, or confidential status, or something else on that nature. And so directly into Office apps, we have the ability to protect documents, you have the ability to tag content. And those tags sit with the actual metadata of that actual document, or PowerPoint presentation, or Excel spreadsheet, or what have you. And it's discoverable. So now I'm able to search for the term market. I think it's market. Yeah, market or marketing or whatnot, and find this content as it traverses the network. And this metadata will actually go not will actually even go as it leaves the organization. So it'll stay with the document permanently. So what does this look like from when you're thinking about data governance from an email perspective? And you want to say, I have 10 different business groups that think about data slightly differently. Or you might just say, actually, everyone in my organization has to think about data permanently. I have a global policy to say, all content must be purged from the organization after 5 years, or moved to the archive for tiered storage or other reasons after a certain period of time. And so we've actually improved the process of actually having the ability to provision policies very, very simply. So I have a number of different policies that I've just created here. And you can see some of them are archive policies here. And these archive policies will allow me to do things that are more mailbox management oriented. Right? So I specifically choose the word mailbox management because mailbox an archive policy for Microsoft is a way to move data from one location to another location. It's still discoverable. It's still manageable. It's a different storage mechanism for you. But I also have this content called delete policies, as you can see here. And these delete policies allow me to purge content or move it to the deleted items folder for my organization. And this is very important from a data governance standpoint to say, actually, this content must leave. It's done, and I'm not subject to a subpoena or some other form of investigative request for data. And so these are provisioned directly from Outlook Web App in the the control panel in OWA options in EAC to pull off this data governance capability. To the end user, if you can either say, actually you don't have a choice, you're gonna get our policies, or you can say you have the choice to tag items uniquely, and I'm gonna allow you to tag an item with an archive policy or tag an item with a retention policy based on how you deem this data relevant. And to the user, they get a very, very clean single interface for finding and managing that policy. So they can modify it from Outlook, they can modify it from Outlook Web App. Wherever they are, they can see that some of that data. One thing that we also learned during a lot of that research was you can't surprise users. If you do something to a user that they weren't expecting, it's bad. So as much as you can do to inform a user, hey, this content looks like it's going to disappear, or it's changing, or there's a policy applied to that, is better. The worst thing in the world would be, or not the worst thing in the world, but a pretty terrible thing would be to have this user that's been working on a very long email or other content or something like that, and they're using their drafts folder or replying to a message and just trying to keep it actioned around. Today they have it. Tomorrow a policy hits and that item is gone. Right? It just disappears from your organization. To the user, they're like, wait, I still had work to do. I still needed to do it. And they didn't have any notice of what it is. So with Outlook, we now have the ability to actually see the retention policy that's being applied to each item, as well as the expiry. So you know, hey, this item's going to expire in an hour, or in a day, or 2 days, or a week. And if there's an archive policy, you'll see that at the bottom of every single message that's being tagged with it. And this also speaks to some of that flexibility capability that we, from an admin perspective, you can say, I'm actually going to enforce a policy, and anything that's in my deleted items will be purged after 30 days or 60 days or however much you want to do. Or you can say, actually, no, you have a choice. You can set it to whatever you feel comfortable with. And I have the example of archive policy where you say, actually, actually, I want to manage the storage of my mailboxes slightly different, and I want to move everything from my primary mailbox to my archive mailbox after 6 months. And this is available on every single folder that the user has. So just that level of control and capability and flexibility is so unique to Exchange. That really makes it a very powerful story from a data governance perspective. So with that, I'm going to switch and do a quick demo of data loss prevention. I think that was 8. How many people are familiar with the concept of data loss prevention? We've shown it a few times during the session. There's a number of different vendors out there that have DLP solutions. And what I want to show you is what we're doing in the email space from DLP. So I'm logged into a mailbox, and I have the ability to, and for just a normal end user, I want to say, oh, I have a new email message saying that, you know, let's send some content ideas back. This looks very interesting. I'm going to reply with the attachment that they're looking for. Maybe I'll just attach them all. How does this look? And the first thing you see is at the top, you have a policy tip as well as a mail tip that pop up to the end user saying, hey, just so you know, this user is outside of your organization. That's the mail tip. And by the way, this message contains some sensitive information. You should probably think about that. And it'll highlight that the attachments that have it, or if it's in line in the body, you'll see that lit up as well. So you have if I hover over the policy tip, you say, okay, well, I want to learn more about this. And it says, there's actually credit card numbers in here. Our organization's policy is that you shouldn't be able to send credit card numbers outside of your organization. Or you're only allowed to send one credit card number in an email or 5 credit cards in an email. So we want to say, you know, so this is the this is policy that the IT implements with HR's permission or with the policy control group and says, we want to not allow credit card numbers. And I'll walk you through some of the other policies that are available for you. But the interesting thing about this, and this is actually patent pending, where we have the ability to notify the user directly in context of what they're doing. One thing that was interesting to me is I actually sat down and I looked at Microsoft's email, IT, and HR policy guidebooks. And I'll pick on Paul here. Paul, do you know how many pages that policy book is for Microsoft? It's in the hundreds of pages, right? It is, and some of it's web content, so it's tough to exactly say, but it's in the hundreds of pages if you actually print it out. And I'm going to guarantee that you have not read it all and memorized it all. No. Probably fair. Has anyone read the entire HR policy for their organization and memorized it all? Right? Like, no one has. It's not a realistic thing for people to do. At the same time, I know Paul very well. He's a good guy. He's not going to go out of his way to break a rule or regulation that the company requires. But he may do something accidentally. And having the ability to tell your users, hey, just so you know, what you're about to do could be a really bad thing at the point of non-compliance is massively important. Because if you're going to do this, there's a good chance that Paul's then going to go and say, oh, I want to know more about this organization policy so I don't make this mistake in the future. The other thing that's interesting is that we have the ability to what we call override. So let's say I remove some of these attachments with some of the credit card numbers. I don't know if I have that set up in this one. But it's the ability to override. Now, I think I have a screenshot where you can say, actually, I've discussed this with my manager. I've discussed this with HR. And I do have a business need to send out, for this example, a credit card number. Maybe I'm making hotel bookings for the team or something else like that. In that instance, I can say, I'm going to override this with my manager's approval. And it'll kick off an audit and incident report. So notifying the organization that, hey, someone did this. And you should be aware of what's happened. So we're not blocking the, obviously this is an optional thing, but we're not blocking the users from getting their work done unless you have to do that, right? And so it's a very unique way of thinking about DLP in that construct. The other interesting thing, it's not just Outlook that'll do these DLP rules. So Outlook has the engine built in, but it's also server-side scanning. So if you're using your iPhone or if you're using your tablets or whatever, you can send that message off. It'll hit our transport rules. Think about the logic, and actually you'll get an NDR back. And that same override experience can exist off of an NDR as well. And so I'll show you what that looks like. So this is a message that I just sent from just using a simple client. And I get an NDR back saying, actually, delivery not authorized, message refused. So even though it left my outbox, it's still capturing that policy that I want at the server side and making sure that there aren't any sort of leaks around. So when we think about DLP in general, there's actually four distinct things we want to make sure we think about. One is identity. We need to make sure that we know who is sending this message and we're verifying exactly who it's going to and what it's thinking about. Let me just write these in real quick so I can walk around. Easy to use, in case you can't read my handwriting. The second one is making sure we have a very robust monitoring engine. And I'll show you what we're doing from a reporting standpoint and making sure all these things are actually triggered and working as you'd expect. The third is actually protecting your data, right? Like, you actually have to do the work to make sure that the DLP is functioning. And fourth, similar to what I was showing from an archiving perspective, is making that really easy to use. People are used to using Outlook. They don't need another add-in or some other experience for that. Having that built directly into the product and simple to use is something that we spent a lot of effort and time thinking about for DLP. So I want to talk to you a little bit about how DLP works. So first, the admin is going to sit there and understand, what are my policies that I need to put to? So he's going to go on and set up just the DLP policy config. It's going to send that to the server. Server is going to understand what's going on there. And it's going to push out the policy to Outlook on everyone's desktop. And this is the Outlook policy distribution. Right? And so Outlook will then cache the policy on a daily basis so that it understands exactly what it's doing. If you need to do it on a more frequent basis, you can actually change that as needed. But for most organizations, having the policy change, you're not changing your data loss prevention policies hourly unless it's during testing. And that's something that we can address normally. Once it's there, the policies are then evaluated. So as a message is sent, this policy evaluation happens on the server side. And if anything ever is triggered, if anything is ever triggered, it goes to the audit and incident generation. Right? And so that audit and incident generation will file off a report to the appropriate individuals or distribution lips so you know exactly what's happening from that perspective. It's pretty simple, but just knowing that those policies have to make their way to the Outlook clients is important so that you have that pop-up policy tip appear for those end users. From a policy template perspective, we have a number of different out-of-the-box policies. Each policy is made up of a number of different rules. So you'll have a rule to say, what happens with when you have, like, for instance, one incident of this sort, or five incidents of this sort, or perhaps you want to take a different action if it's 10 incidents. One of those things could be just monitor, five could be, or 10 could be take action, and then 20 or 100 could be block, right? So different levels of control on what it's there. And within these templates, you have the sensitive content types to say, what is the actual content that we're using in these templates to take action on? And I'll show you what that looks like as well. Out of the box, we have about 50 sensitive content types around the world. It's not just US. We have content from, for instance, the German passport numbers. We have content from Canada. We have content from Australia as well to make sure that we have global sort of representation from a content type perspective. It's also very extensible, right? So we have the ability to say, if you need to make your own engines, or if you need to, make your own policy types and say, in our organization, an ID is 9 digits with this algorithm, it's fully XML-based, and I have a picture of that, what that looks like in another slide. So in each template, as I was mentioning, there's a sensitive content type, or numbers of sensitive content type, and then the rules. There's the predicate. Right, so this is what we call the condition or predicate. On what are you choosing as your subject? Like what are you going to take action on? The second one is the action. And this is the what are you going to do if you catch one of these conditions? And if you need to, you can have an exception. And this is going to say, perhaps, maybe the CEO is not applicable to these policy rules or something to that sort. This is in every single rule. And by default, the ones that are out of the box have these filtered. For instance, this is for PCI DSS. And you can modify or change them as you need for your rules. One of the interesting actions that people often take is, if I find something very sensitive, and I'll take that credit card example that I was using, maybe I don't want to block them, or maybe I don't even want to really monitor them. But I want to perhaps put rights management or IRM directly on that message. So we have the ability to say, if this predicate happens or if this condition happens, select an appropriate RMS template and maybe put company confidential here. And if you put company confidential as the RMS template, maybe it's going to say, do not forward or do not reply all or something else like that. And this is something that you can do server-side. And so no matter what client they're using, they're going to be able to access it for your organization. One of the other important things that's highlighted here is the ability to test rules, right? So we have the capability to say, we're going to make this implementation, or we're going to check out, make sure that, or we're going to, sorry, we're about to roll out this this template. But before we do, we're going to test it. It's actually the default is test mode. And in that test mode, you can get statistics and understanding of how much you're doing, and you can change your levels appropriately so you're not causing undue stress on your users. As you're ready, then you can enforce, or you can monitor and enforce as well as it's moving through. In that test mode, or actually even in the enforce mode, you're going to see pretty powerful reports. It's actually tough to simulate a little bit with a demo tenant, because most times you're not getting too much email, or you're not spamming, or you're not doing illegal activity. So most of the times you'll see some level of chart here, and perhaps there's a spike or something like that. And you can see what the policies are being matched upon, and if there's any overrides or any false positives that people are reporting for everything. It's actually very powerful. You can even export it to Excel and actually run your own, create your own tables and charts and things like that to understand exactly what's happening with your data. In Microsoft, we use this internally, obviously, and we look at some of that data, and we actually change what we do to make sure that we're not missing out on a threat or actually leaking information outside of our organization that we weren't aware of or expecting. So how does that work? What is the process for analyzing the content in a DLP message or in a message in general? First is it looks to see what is that content? It's going to look in the body of the email. It's going to look in the subject. It's going to look in attachments where it can. For things that it cannot do, you can take a separate action on, right? So if there's a password-protected zip, we're not going to be able to crack that open and understand what's in that password-protected zip. And you can actually say, we're not going to allow password-protected zips or corrupt files or other behavior that's not there. But anything that we can index or crack open, we will look through. So we're going to look through the message, and we're going to see, okay, well, there's a name, there's a credit card number, and there's expires. And this happens through regex. We're going to look through that and say that, okay, this is a 16-digit number. 16 digits, it could be a Visa card, it could be a MasterCard. Amex is 15 digits. Let's do something special on this and make sure that it's okay or it's not okay or it's making it. So then we're going to do a function analysis where we're looking at that 16-digit number and say, all right, what is the logic that we're doing for this to make sure that it matches our thing? If it's an ID card number or if it's a, in the U.S. there's a social security number. It's an identifiable information. For the credit card information number, it's 16 digits. And there's an algorithm in the credit card industry called Lund's algorithm or Lund algorithm. It's a way of saying that this is a valid credit card number or it's just 16 digits, right? There could just be 16 digits that are associated with that. So it looks through and says, all right, this 4485 number, it matches a checksum, and the second number doesn't match, so that's not real credit card number. And this will be applicable for any of those content types that we were talking about. The interesting thing is that both Visa, this is a little bit off the specific slide, but both Visa and MasterCard have very specific numbers that you need to show for demoing credit card numbers. Visa's number is 4 and then 15 ones, and then MasterCard is 5, 111, and then the last number is something different. And both of those numbers actually pass Lund's algorithm, but they're good numbers to use for demoing if you ever need to test something like this out. So that was the functional analysis. For most things, though, we want to make sure that there is some what we call corroborative evidence, something that can support that this is actually you're putting a credit card number through. So in the credit card industry, you can't actually do too much with just that 16-digit number. You're going to need an expiry date. You're going to need the CCM, the special 3-digit number, or you're going to need some other level of data. So for this one, we have if the word keyword Visa is there, or MasterCard, or expires, or some other corroborative evidence, we're going to say, all right, now we're increasing the likelihood that this is actually a credit card. Finally, we're going to Outlook or Exchange is going to say, yes or no, this is a credit card number, this is not a credit card number, and we're going to make the verdict and then apply it to that rule set. So in this top one, you can see that there's one credit card number here, and sure enough, yes. And then this one is a booking code with 16 digits, and that one does not pass the analysis engine. If you do have an incident where something gets matched and you want to make sure that you're tracking it and auditing it, we will send an incident report. And you can choose who you want to send this incident report to. And it has a number of different things that will have it. First is, what is the actual content? So you can see message was sent to Bob, severity medium. So it had some content that was sensitive, but not, everyone's bankroll information because it has a lot more PII. Was there an override pressed? No. Was the false positive notified? No as well. Second is, what is the rule? So that's right here. What is the rule that actually worked on? This is really important because if you ever need to troubleshoot, you can say, all right, that one hit over here, and I'm looking at the credit card classification. I think it was, credit card number, data classification. There was one count. So one count means that there was one credit card in there. Our confidence, it's similar to, for those of you that have ever been to spam reports, you can see this SCL. similar sort of theories with our confidence for DLP. And so this is 85. Anything above 85, we're going to mark and make sure it's an incident, according to this policy that's set up, and what the rule hit that's there. And finally, you can actually see the exact information that's there. More demo. All right. We'll do another demo soon then. How about we demo some XML? One thing that you can do, right, as I was mentioning with the ID numbers for your card, or if there's a unique ID form, you can just take that. It's all just XML on the infrastructure, and take that and match it to your business needs, and move that into a policy template. This is something that you can do personally, or you can there's companies out there that will have additional policy engines that you can download, or policy templates that you can download, and extensible, and add it to your infrastructure. One last thing about DLP, and then I'll switch topics a little bit, is that auditing and reporting those charts and slides out of the box is actually only available for our online product. So it's only available with Exchange Online. So we talked to Dell, who said, okay, this is interesting. We have a number of different reporting engines available for us as well. And so they've actually extended their Message Stats Business Insights product to do DLP reporting for on-premises Exchange 2013. So if this is important to you and you want to get that auditing and reporting capabilities for it's not the auditing, it's just the reporting capabilities. Audits out of the box from an Exchange perspective. You might want to look at this Dell product. So switching gears to Link. Link 2013 and Link Online as well has the ability to integrate Link content directly into Exchange. Right? There was a previous capabilities in from the client side, which would do conversation history. Is anyone familiar with conversation history in Link? And this is a feature that it's a very much an end user feature to say, all right, this conversation is important, so it's going to stay in my conversation history folder in Outlook. But it required so many different, there were so many scenarios where that just broke, right? It needed Outlook open, it needed Link open, you needed to have them open during the same time, so and Link needed to write to Outlook, and then Outlook would then write to the server side. So from a compliance standpoint, it didn't actually do much. You weren't going to guarantee that data was there, you're not going to make it available anywhere. So we kind of went back to the drawing board in the 2013 products, and we now do it server side. So it's tied to hold. So if you're placing a hold on content or you're placing a query-based hold for someone's data, it's now going to be tied directly to that store, and it's going to store directly in Exchange. It uses LYSS and the UDC to actually write this content into it. How you do it, it can happen at the global level, the site level, or the service level. And you just enable this flag by setting this PowerShell script here. And by setting that flag, you're now basically combining those pieces together from an Exchange and Link perspective. If you then want to enable just an individual user, you can do set-cs user as well. And that'll change the policy type to for that user as needed. So how did it work previously? So if you needed to actually find this data or preserve the data, the compliance officer in parallel with the IT person would say, all right, let's set up a policy here to Link, let's set up a different policy to Exchange, and if we ever have to find that data, we'll use a DB analyzer on the Link side, and we'll use multi-mailbox search on the Exchange side and try and correlate information so that we can present it in court of law or some other request. In 2013, as I mentioned, we're now saying, let's take this Link data, and if hold is there, we'll move that over to the new versions of Exchange. And that compliance officer now just doesn't need to learn a separate tool. They use their e-discovery capabilities, and they can just search directly in Exchange. Really simplifying that experience from a compliance perspective. What does that mean from an actual architecture storage perspective? So if I have that user on hold from Exchange and from Link, that setting is then passed on to the server, and Link says, okay, is that instant messaging, is that instant message subject to the hold? Is that meeting, was there some keyword in there that makes it subject to the hold? If so, let's take that information and send it to Exchange. And Exchange doesn't store this in some place that is user accessible, or at least easily user accessible. It stores it in the recoverable items folder, which is in part of the non-IPM subtree, in a hidden container, which is the purges container. And it'll keep these in the purges container until the hold is expired, or if it's a query, or if it's a time-based in-place hold, until the hold expires. And it'll keep subjecting that to the time frame. We also sync the hold state. Between Exchange and Link. So you're making sure that you don't have some of your data on hold, not part of the other data. You set that user on hold, he's on hold, no matter whether it's Exchange or Link or SharePoint or whatnot. There is something you need to do from a discoverability perspective to actually find that user for the compliance officer, for the person that's actually doing it. There is a, by default, empty role group called discovery management. And for the person that is going to be, person or people that will be doing discovery, you need to add that user to that role group so they have the capability of searching everyone's mailbox or searching a subset of people to that infrastructure. On-premises, you for setting up the SharePoint side, you'll have to set some of these site permissions as well, but that's separate to the Link side. That on the Link, you just have to add the role group member and set the CS user for the appropriate information. So where is that data? If you open up, this is EWS Editor. Has anyone used EWS Editor? It's a way of kind of getting a geeky view into the mailbox. You can see here, if I look at my purges folder, I can see all of these IPM note that have information from IAMs right here. And one of them is, can we talk about the TR16 demo? And sure enough, there's it'll show up in that well as well. So you can guarantee that is visible from the server side as well. So some of the gotchas. I want to make sure that you're all aware of some of the gotchas to make sure you don't make those same mistakes. I kind of learned this the hard way, that I was looking for an audio conference to make sure that everything was there. And Link will actually wait 20 minutes before sending that information to Exchange, specifically just for audio conference, I guess video as well. If you do need to make it go faster, you want to invoke CS storage service flush, and that'll just push it directly through. If you don't have a default meeting, archive conferences will only have a subject. And so you can see, using that same tool, EWS Editor, you're going to just see non-default meeting here. It makes it a little bit tricky when you're trying to find that message, but know that the actual content of that meeting is being captured. All right, now let's think a little bit about e-discovery. And then we're gonna do a demo to satisfy some Jeff. When I talk to organizations around the world about e-discovery, there's this framework called the EDRM framework. It's the Electronic Discovery Reference Model. If you go to edrm.net, you'll see a very interesting view of how people think about data as it moves across the life cycle. For us, we compartmentalize it that entire thing into four distinct arrays. One is identification and preservation of that data, search and process, review, and then actually produce that data in a court of law or something like that. Historically, people don't, or organizations would take their data and they would try and find it and try and just do things on the fly. And it made that process of starting out with a discovery request and actually producing that data very, very painful. In Microsoft, with the 2010 suite of products and a number of different avenues, the average time for responding to a discovery request was in the 3-week time frame. With 2013, we're hoping to move that into the 6-hour time frame with actual data and things like that. So one of the things that's interesting when you think about e-discovery is you have just this massive, massive volume of data. And lawyers think about data in terms of pages. It's just the framework that they're using. The average court case has about 13 million pages that they start off with that they want a subject to look through and understand what that is. 13 million pages is an absolute unreasonable amount for any lawyer to go through. And in the average rate in the US is $1,000 an hour for a lawyer. $1,000 an hour for a lawyer to turn 13,000 pages would not be feasible for most organizations. And so we have this just massive amount of volume. Right? And it's our goal to make that volume of data more and more relevant. So we want to increase that volume of data as you move across from identification to preservation. That says relevance. As you make the data pipeline smaller and smaller and smaller, you want to make sure that the data that's there is more and more and more relevant to the case or the information at hand. The average case in Microsoft that gets turned around is about 243 pages. So taking 13 million pages, turning in 243 is something that we do in Microsoft as part of pretty much every single case request. 243 is still a lot at $10,000 or $1,000 an hour to turn the pages up, but it's more manageable and allows the organizations or our organization to take a very, very comprehensive view of the data while still making that content available. So let's switch over. I'm going to do a quick demo on eDiscovery Center here. So what you're looking at is SharePoint's eDiscovery Center. It's a place where we're going to identify, preserve, hold, search, and export content in your organization. And it'll find Exchange, SharePoint, and Link, as we've been discussing. But it'll also even find file server information if you're using on-premises SharePoint 2013. So it's an interesting way of looking at structured and unstructured data in your organization from a single console. So a little story. When lawyers would go to meetings, or when lawyers had a request for, hey, there's a lawsuit pending, or there's an investigation that they need to understand, the process would be called pre-review, or at least pre-review in the US, where the lawyer would go and say, all right, I'm going to go meet with the other lawyers. And the three lawyers on the one side would have a meeting with the three lawyers on the other side, and they'd sit in a room for 4 or 5 hours and understand, all right, so who are the people of the investigation, who are what we call custodians of the data, what are the terms that we're going to be interested in, what are the keywords we're going to use, what time frame are we going to go through, and they'd sit there at $1,000 an hour times 6 and go and make that decision. Then they'd come back to the respective companies and pass that information off to IT. IT would then take a week or 2 weeks. You guys would be much faster, I'm assuming, and respond to that request of data and just give them hard drives of data and say, all right, this is everything you asked for. Or they would give them, you know, too little data. lawyers would look at that and say, all right, well, this is not enough or this is too much. And they would go back to another, have another meeting with those lawyers. They said, okay, we have too much data or we have not enough data. And so they change the keywords a little bit, move them around until, and they did, this process would usually go on usually about two times, to be fair. And then they'd finally get the terms that would come out. But the interesting thing is it doesn't have to be that slow. It doesn't have to be that painful of an experience. And so we built the eDiscovery Center to be built for those custodians, or for those lawyers, for those compliance officers, to get the data that they want directly and not take up the time of IT. I mean, at the end of the day, not too many IT people want to sit there and just pull data and pass it off to another medium. It's not particularly a valuable use of time for IT. So this is the eDiscovery Center. This is where that compliance officer, that legal person, is going to spend the majority of their discovery request time. And here, there's two tasks. One is to identify the content and then place it on hold. I hope it doesn't authenticate me again. All right. So this is where that same process that they could go and have that pre-review meeting that they'd be going back and forth. Now our lawyers actually just walk in with a laptop and say, all right, well, what are the terms that you want to discuss? And they say, well, looks like Garth Fort has been doing some interesting things. Katie Jordan has been doing some interesting things. Is there a repository somewhere that you keep data relevant to the Northwind Traders case? And our eDiscovery folks can say, yeah, actually, let's just make sure. Let's put Garth Fort on hold. Let's put Katie Jordan on hold. Add two locations on SharePoint that are relevant. Perhaps add a file server location. And I won't hit OK here. And you can see there, okay, well, there's 270 items that actually meet this query. It's an empty query, but just 270 items that are relevant to this case. And right there, during that pre-review meeting, they're being able to understand, is this too much information? Is this not enough information? And like, just really, really speed up that process. Once they're happy with that, you know, they can filter, they can change the start dates, whatever they'd like. You can preview the results. So you can actually, since the data sits directly in Exchange and directly in SharePoint, you don't have to pull the data from anywhere. You're seeing this data live. You're seeing the actual data. I can click on this and see link instant messages. I can see SharePoint's team sites. I can see individual PDFs, whatever you want that's stored in SharePoint. If I'm happy with that, I enable in-place hold. I hit save. And now my immutability train is kicked off, and all of this content is going to be placed on hold. And you're not actually causing any storage pains at this point either, because it's being kept on in-place hold. So basically, a flag goes off on Exchange or a flag goes off on SharePoint, say that this content is not to be changed. If you do want to change it, sure, go ahead and change it. But we'll instantiate a copy on write to create a secondary copy of that data. And so you have that older version there as well. So now you have that case that's going ongoing, and you're looking through all that data. And maybe you need to actually go and actually analyze it further and understand what sort of content is there. Maybe it has to go to a full-on trial or audit or something to that level. And here we have the Northwind Traders case, and they're doing a full query. And we've introduced what we call, we don't call it, but it's called KQL, Keyword Query Language. And this query language allows the use of term or use of query language that is more applicable to the lawyer vernacular. Right? In many instances, they want to be able to make sure that they capture enough data. And so we're going to use terminology like near. Which is a proximity search. So in this example, I have Northwind basically with Northwind within 30 words of the word cantoso or trad star. So making sure I catch traders, trading, any sort of instance that I'm using the word trad, and where Northwind is there in some 30-word window. Now, in real life, lawyers have Excel spreadsheets with hundreds of queries or dozens of queries, and they're copying, pasting 30-word queries or 100-word queries into the search terms and just making sure they're right. So having that ability there right out at your fingertips is pretty important. So within that query word, or within that search, I can see that, all right, well, Garth has 6 items, Katie has 5, and there's a few more that are there in the SharePoint locations. Another interesting thing that lawyers like is, okay, well, which part of my query was relevant in finding that data? Do I need to tweak some part of that query? And so what we do is we do query statistics to say, all right, so here's my full search, and it found 68 items. If I break it down and say, Northwind within 30 words of Contoso, or just Trad Star, or different variations, and I can even go further and understand what the query would have done individually, and so I can change and modify my queries to be more applicable for the results. I can click on these. Let me see if there's an instant message or something. And I would see that specific message show up in Outlook Web App. And it's a specialized version of Outlook. Version's not the right word, but it's a specialized view of Outlook Web App where you're not going to get the reply, forward, or editing buttons. You're just going to get a read-only view so that you just can't tamper with that content. I'll pick on a SharePoint one then. From a SharePoint perspective, we'll capture all of these site mailbox or all of the SharePoint sites, well, wikis, RSS feeds, documents, PDFs, anything that we can get, we're going to try and capture in this. So this is a Word doc. Let's find that one that's... And because it is a web page, you're going to get the fully rendered version of that. And so the compliance officer can actually dive in and say, all right, well, is there something in here? Is the structure of this page interesting to me? Is there any metadata that's interesting to me? And really understand what's going on from this. If you want to filter, we have refiners, and so you can capture OneNote notebooks or PowerPoint presentations or ASPX pages, things like that. It's something that a lot of e-discovery companies actually can't do is look at OneNote notebooks, which is somewhat interesting because people take a lot of thoughts and ideas and notes, which are very relevant in investigations and notebooks. But lawyers that are using the third-party tools actually have to take everyone's notebooks and scan them individually or ask them to print them to PDF or some other way of accessing that data outside of their native SharePoint tools or native e-discovery tools. So once they're happy with that, there's usually some level of review, human review process, or you have to send it to third-party counsel. And so we have built-in export capabilities in eDiscovery Center. So I can hit that export button. And we've worked with organizations around the world to build out a standardized protocol for export, and it's what we call EDRM XML. And so you're going to be able to import this with all the relevant metadata into a third-party tool or into something on third-party counsel would have and actually understand all of that richness directly from the right tools. At the same time, we want to make sure that we have the right tools to minimize the volume of data that you're exporting and having to learn your opposing counsel manage. So we have a few checkboxes here. One is removing duplicate exchange content. So this is dedupe on the exchange side to say, instead of having 10 different emails, just have one with the appropriate metadata to say that this was in this folder in Encore's mailbox, and this folder in Scott's mailbox, and this folder in Jeff's mailbox. et cetera, et cetera. Really bringing down, again, $1,000 an hour. The less content you have to produce, the better. Similarly, if you don't want to include all the versions of, or if you want to include all of the versions of every single file you've captured and versioning is enabled, you can check the version checkbox there to, if you have to produce all the, that sort of content. And then the third one is, well, what should we do about interesting content that we don't have the ability to traverse? Encrypted content, unrecognizable file forms, corrupted content, things like that. Do you want to manage them as a one-off process? If you have multiple queries, you can select them all and you can export them. And what it'll do is it'll kick off a client-side click run or run once download. And that download will then download that, I think it was 68 items, directly to my laptop here. And I don't have to go to a separate repository. And it's available to me anywhere that Outlook or that the SharePoint content is as well. If I just wanted to get the report, I could get the report. If I want to get the full export result, you can see that it's launching this application. You just choose the location you want to save it to. Once it lets me log in, it's thinking I'm some other user, but basically, you choose the location you want to save it to, and it'll export that content in EDR and XML. The way it's going to do it is, for every custodian, you're going to have a PST, so you're capturing the raw data for that user. So you would have Encore's PST, you have Jeff's PST, unless you've chosen to dedupe that content, and then you just get a larger PST with the appropriate metadata file to say that these items, this ID, is in the appropriate folders. On the SharePoint side, you'll get a list of every single document directly, and each web page that is captured will be captured in MHT format, which is MIME HTML. It's basically a web page complete encapsulation of a page. So you are getting all the icons, all the visuals that are a part of that page. And then you'll get that metadata.xml file with all the metadata. And you'll also have any sort of errors or logs or anything else that were interesting that'll be stored for your users or for your admins. And so you can see all the exports that are run. And if I wanted to, I can select multiple and do interesting things and have multiple exports running at the same time or different queries on the content as well. All right. Switch back over. And with that, I just want to, you know, there's a few interesting resources, mostly on the policy tip side. There's a lot of templates. There's advice about managing templates, some of the policies that are there, file types that are relevant for this. We have some questions, but if you are interested, you can see the annotated version of this slide deck. You can download it at aka.ms/exl324. I think the PowerPoint that I use as a basis for some of this content is available. I don't know where you guys get PowerPoints from, but I'm assuming from the tech ed place. And then we also have a free OneNote template. I hope you guys have all been using that during the conference. Please feel free to download that one on your desktop as well. So any questions? Anything else that you'd like to ask? No? Yes?
You were saying that an NDR will be sent back if, say, you're sending from your device. That NDR comes back and you showed the header. Does that actually include which policy it hit to cause the NDR?
To the end user, you're asking?
Continually get NDRs, but there's no information to say
I don't believe it does. It says it's rejected because it doesn't meet policy. I can look into it a little bit, though. Yes. Yeah, so we're working on Yammer as well. Yammer has incorporated the EDR and base XML export. So you will be able to export from there and have a similar format. But it's something that we're thinking about, how better to incorporate the Yammer capabilities from eDiscovery into our tool sets. Yep. All right, well, one more question, yes. Yeah.
Is that a replacement for it?
I think it's similar. They're just slightly different, yeah. I don't think MFC Mappy has really been coded against in a long time.
No.
And so the EWS components are a little bit weaker.
Okay.
So, cool. Well, anyways, thank you for your time. Enjoy the rest of the show.